Good afternoon, everyone. It is Dr. Nigro again with our next episode of Psychology Unplugged. Thank you to all of our listeners. I appreciate all the comment and the feedback. I'm sorry I still sound a little nasally, probably from singing so loud at the concert last week. But we had, an amazing time, and we're trying to do more on Instagram and getting more stuff out there. Appreciate all of your comments and feedbacks, and very grateful. I think you got a lot of people coming in from different parts of the country, some from different parts of the world in the next few weeks. Really happy to connect with you. I still have to connect to one person in Kenya. But I will definitely do my best to get back to everyone. And again, from Julie and I, thank you so much. There she is, making noise, of course, for your continued support. So as our podcast has continued to grow, you know, I still do a lot of these off the top of my head, but I've become more conscientious with keeping, making notes, so I can cover the things that I find to be most relevant. And, Julie, as her style, may or may not jump in, but today we're going to cover panic disorder, which is a separate disorder in the anxiety disorder category or classifications in the DSM. And panic is something that, is a fairly common phenomenon with anxiety. Some people call them anxiety attacks, panic attacks, which are the most common cause of emergency room visits in the United States, mainly because they mimic cardiac symptoms. And I'll go through a list of the 13 common symptoms that are associated with panic. Basically, panic is, these are recurrent episodes of panic attacks. And a panic attack is really like this, an abrupt surge of intense fear and discomfort that reaches a peak within minutes. It's almost instantaneous. And during that time, you have to meet criteria for the four or following of these 13 diagnostic criteria. And for those of you who have experienced panic, I'm sure you could easily connect and resonate with what I'm about to go over. So the first one is palpitations, pounding heart, or accelerated heart rate. This is one of the most common physiological symptoms of panic. Is pulse rate goes up, respiration goes up, breathing can become more shallow. People can feel like they're hyperventilating. Sweating. Sweating is another very common one. Also, if your heart rate's increasing, you're more likely to sweat. Trembling or shaking, whether that could be usually in the extremities, the hands, the feet rocking back and forth. Seriously, with the water. Back and forth. And if you can see, just take those first three. Palpitations, pounding heart, accelerated heart rate, sweating, trembling, shaking. Those very much sound like cardiovascular symptoms, whether that's a heart attack or a stroke or, God forbid, a combination of either one. Feelings of choking, feeling like you're not getting enough air. Chest pain or discomfort. Again, do you see how much this sounds like the onset of a heart attack? And the mind could go very quickly to a dark place. Feeling dizzy, nausea or abdominal distress, kind of feeling queasy, sick to the stomach, feeling like you're going to throw up, maybe gagging. Feeling dizzy, unsteady, lightheaded, or faint. Again, if the respiration is going to be altered, you're probably not getting enough carbon dioxide into the body. So you may have a feeling of faintness and like you're going to, lightheadedness, and feel like you're going to pass out. Chills or heat sensations. Paresthesias, which is numbing or tingling sensations. Usually you'll feel that in the fingertips and the toes, again, the extremities. Derealization, which is feelings of uncertainty or unreality. and depersonalization, being kind of feeling detached from oneself. And a lot of people that I work with, they confuse the term dissociation with derealization and depersonalization, which is a separate disorder in and of itself. And it's usually linked to extreme or elevated levels of either generalized anxiety, panic, a combination of the both. But it is not psychosis. It is not in any way related to, dissociation is really related much more to trauma, where derealization and depersonalization are related much more to anxiety. The 12th one, fear of losing control or going crazy. Many people will report that they feel like they're losing their minds, that something is wrong with me, especially people who have repeated panic attacks. And the 13th one is a fear of dying. So if you look at these constellation, and you only have to meet four of symptoms, many of which are physiological, it kind of makes sense why people are going to pick up the phone and call 911 or go to urgent care. And I would say always err on the side of caution. If you are experiencing these symptoms, yes, it could be anxiety. It could be panic. It could be, you know, some stressor. But if you're having these symptoms, please err on the side of caution and seek medical assistance, whether that's in the emergency room. And if it's like heart, you know, cardiac, they'll check your troponin levels. They'll do a whole range of tests. But it panic can be incredibly debilitating, and, you know, leading to, you know, more intense anxiety. It can occur in the context of depression, of just generalized anxiety, of bipolarity, really all of the psychiatric conditions panic is associated with. So again, the key diagnostic feature is it's recurrent, unexpected panic attacks. Which again, that abrupt surge of symptoms. And really abrupt means a lot of times it comes out of nowhere, and treatment can sometimes be a little difficult because you really, you know, takes a while. X does cause Y, and from a psychotherapeutic standpoint, you're really trying to find out we kind of differentiate panic attacks. We have like what are called the unexpected panic attacks, which are panic attacks where there's no obvious cue or trigger at the time that it occurs. It seems to kind of come out of the blue when someone's relaxing, emerging from sleep, which is called a nocturnal panic attack, versus expected panic attacks for which there is an obvious cue or trigger. So the expected panic attacks, it's usually, you know, if you have had a panic attack riding elevators, or have had an anxiety attack as a passenger in a car stuck in traffic, those would be expected panic attacks. The unexpected ones get a little trickier because you don't know really where they're coming from, but the body is obviously responding, and this is the sympathetic nervous system at its most heightened state of the fight or flight response, where, you know, blood flow is diverted to, you know, major muscle groups and organs. Eyesight can become heightened. You know, blood flow is diverted from the sexual organs, from gastrointestinal system. It's diverted there to give the body fuel and energy, because we have two main, you know, mechanisms as humans. And one is procreation, and the second is survival. So panic can very much be related to the sympathetic nervous system in being in a state of survival. And oftentimes coming out of a panic attack, people have reported that they feel like they've run a marathon. They feel like they were on the treadmill for 40 minutes because the body is working so hard, obviously in response to something that it perceives as it being in danger, or some perceived threat to the homeostasis of the physiological system. So in terms of frequency, they can be moderate, where it's kind of like one per week for months at a time. Short bursts, they're daily, separated by weeks. And again, you have to have four of those 13 symptoms. And the worries about panic attacks and their consequences usually pertain like to physical concerns, such as worry that the panic attacks are representing life-threatening illnesses, cardiac disease, seizures, social concerns like embarrassment or fear, fear of being judged negatively, because there are very visible signs with panic disorder. So if you see somebody in a restaurant, you know, kind of shaking or rocking, or maybe they get to go to the bathroom multiple times, it can lead to a lot of social embarrassment. They don't tend to occur too much in children. And children that have them don't really complain as much, according to the data. It you know, adolescence, young adulthood, they really start to manifest. And I think in the digital world that we live in, the rates of panic attacks with the degree of social comparison and the amount of expectations from a Western civilization mindset and work modality, that panic attack prevalence rates in the United States are about 12%, which is pretty high. Could be lower in some cultures, depending on really the demands of the situation. But the maladaptive changes in behavior really represent attempts to minimize or avoid panic attacks or the consequences. So people may not want to, they may start restricting their daily activities. They could start avoiding agoraphobic type situations, like maybe stop going to the movie theaters. Instead of going out to dinner at 8 o'clock on a Friday or Saturday night, maybe going out at 4 or 5 to avoid crowds. Not leaving the home. Again, that's agoraphobia. That's pretty severe. Avoiding public transportation, which could possibly, depending on where you live, cause a host or variety of socioeconomic problems if you're not able to get to work on time, because feelings of being trapped, standing on a train car or on a crowded bus. Avoiding going to the shopping mall, which could infect, if you're a primary person or if you're living alone, going to the grocery store. Although we have digital apps like Peapod and Whole Foods delivers, and I'm sure in different countries there's similar things than the United States. But agoraphobia is a common comorbid diagnosis that is given with panic disorder. And agoraphobia can be very severe. And you wonder, well, how deleterious is it in at least in the United States from the model post-pandemic, where a lot of people don't have to leave their home in order to go to work. So they can kind of have that safe place of working from their home, meeting their deadlines, and keeping their professional performance and job performance intact with good reviews because they're getting their work done. But the flip side is their social attractiveness may be significantly diminished because they don't want to go out, they don't want to be with other people, they don't want to be around other people. It could start to impact intimate relationships, a husband, a wife, a partner. Hey, it's date night. I don't want to go out. It could affect intimacy. It could affect a whole variety of things. So just you take these 13 symptoms, 4 of which you need in order to have panic disorder, and you can see how it can really spill over into, if you're not going to drive your car, how are you able to get to work? And if you don't want to avoid transportation, you want to avoid public transportation, that can lead to a whole host of other problems. One type of unexpected panic attack is the nocturnal panic attack, which is waking up from sleep in a state of panic, which differs from panicking after fully waking from sleep. So the nocturnal panic attack is actually waking from sleep in a state of panic versus the other panic attack. It occurs after being fully awake. Individuals with panic disorder, often they're anticipating this catastrophic outcome from mild physical symptoms or medication side effects, thinking they have heart disease, or if they have a headache, they have a brain tumor. So it can really go into other disorders, which are the conversion disorders, into illness anxiety disorder. The somatoform disorders, where you can really start to live a life where you're chasing, the MMPI is really good at being able to pick this these disorders up, because these are a lot of times individuals with conversion or somatoform disorders that are like illness anxiety disorder, where, or somatic symptom disorder, where these are individuals who present with a variety of physiological symptoms, gastrointestinal, sleep, autonomic nervous system, cardiac, respiratory, even skin. And they really tend to resist psychological interpretations after all medical explanations have been ruled out. And I can do an episode on specifically on conversion disorder, illness anxiety disorder, and somatic symptom disorder, because these individuals are reporting that they are literally experiencing these symptoms and feel that there's something wrong with their heart. They're getting numerous blood tests. They see multiple specialists. And when they come into the psych world, that's why diagnostics is such a great and such an important tool, because we have tests to be able to pick this stuff up. And you know, it's a little tough working with individuals, because as soon as you say, before you have a strong therapeutic relationship, that it's all in your head, you're lucky if they even show up for another appointment. But you'd also want to, you know, explore alternative possibilities and alternative hypotheses. And yes, these can be treated, but you've heard of, like, you know, Munchausen by proxy, which is, I think, conversion disorder by proxy, where, you know, you've heard of the mother making her children sick and then taking them to the hospital, and then being the savior, or nurses who've, I know there's some that in the news in the past that have made their patients sick, not to the point of dying, but to the point they were the ones that recognized the illness and they were able to give, you know, talk to the doctor and give them the right antibiotic. You know, that is a separate disorder in and of itself, and I have come across that in clinical practice. It's an interesting disorder. It's not very common, but it does persist. But as you can see, how anxiety and panic can really spiral to a lifestyle of constantly searching for an explanation, because if you have physical symptoms, you're looking for a physiological explanation. It makes sense. And it's sometimes hard in working with these individuals to convince them that it is something psychological. And sometimes there's what's called a secondary gain. And again, the MMPI is really good at picking this up. This is when individuals are purposely over-endorsing symptoms, and there are specific scales in the MMPI for physiological symptoms, that there are specific scales that will measure for hypochondriasis. You know, the typical thing, so think of hypochondriac, that measure for, or conversion hysteria, it measures for that. Where people can, you know, it can detect if people are faking symptoms. And you'll sometimes see this when someone's where there's a secondary gain. And by secondary gain, I mean there's a motivation to come across as being impaired, wanting to get Social Security benefits, wanting to get a leave of absence from work, wanting to get, there's something that the individual is wanting to get, that if they present themselves in an impaired or dysfunctional state, that the illness in and of itself, when it's not actually real, will give them the benefits they're looking for. And it's usually easy to catch these individuals in a lie and present them with this, which is, you know, again, something I've come across in clinical practice. So medications are definitely something that people turn to when they want to eliminate panic disorders. And this is where, you know, I don't know if Julie's going to pop in or not, but this is where the benzodiazepines have come in the past. You know, back in the early 60s and 70s, they rushed these pills to the market very quickly. Valium was mother's little helper. Ativan or lorazepam, alprazolam or Xanax, Clonopin or clonazepam. These were ones that worked really quick to eliminate anxiety, and they worked. And people, at least in the United States, have... you know, I think, you know, I know Julie has dealt with this, you know, working for large organizations, have inherited people on multiple meds, sometimes people on Xanax, Clonopin, and Ativan, and that was like old world psychiatry. And I can tell you, people are married to these medications. And it's very hard to get them off of it because you can't just stop them because a lot of them lower the seizure threshold. So they have to be tapered off of these medications very quick, you know, and very by a professional. This is something you just don't want to stop immediately. Low doses of antidepressants, the SSRIs, the SSNRIs, they tend to treat anxiety. But panic is something that is so intense. And it comes on so abruptly, even though I mentioned there's the expected panic attacks, and that's where anticipatory anxiety keeps going in. You know, you could be going to an amusement park with your children, and they want to go on a roller coaster, and that could evoke panic. So it could impair, like, just family dynamics and family relationships and traditions. So it can be very debilitating. But I know Julie has struggled just from our conversations with people. Here's a key. Nobody should know the word benzodiazepine. And if you go into a prescriber, don't say the word, I need a benzo, because it comes across as you're looking for a specific medication. But there's a movement because the University of Cambridge, I mentioned the different episode in the United Kingdom, finally did a longitudinal study which showed that prolonged long-term use of benzodiazepines places individuals at a significantly elevated risk for the onset of dementia. So a lot of providers I know that Julie worked with, a lot of the wonderful colleagues that I work with are trying to pull people off of these medications. But I think there's also a huge psychological addiction to these medications. I'm convinced that if you gave a vast majority of people a placebo, that they would probably feel the same effect, be like, oh my God, it's gone. But these meds work because they work fast. So Julie's here, and I think she's going to pop in. I'm going to let her talk about her experiences with dealing with panic from a pharmacological standpoint.
Hi, guys. Hi, everyone. I thank you so much for your response to... Don't hover. Thank you so much for your response to our last podcast, which was on the coattails of our few days in Boston, seeing Bruce. Well, not actually seeing Bruce on stage, but didn't meet him, yada, yada. Still working on Instagram. I feel like I really need kind of help with that. So that's a work in progress. So again, I apologize for... I wish I were better at it. But I'll get there. You know, it's on my list of things to do. So my apologies that it's not up to snuff at this point in time. I guess, you know, as I was listening, as I was prepping dinner, I always listened to what Cor's talking about. I wasn't sure what he was going to talk about today, but it sounds like the subject is panic disorder. I think a lot of people struggle with panic disorder. I think one of the unique factors with panic disorder is that very often when people experience a panic attack, they're very much afraid of when it's going to rear its ugly head again. And, you know, it can happen anywhere. It really can. It can happen while you're driving. It can, and not everything is, you know, the stimuli that triggers a panic attack isn't always, obvious at all. In fact, if you really think about it, I guess the way that I explain it to my clients is using the five senses. Not discluding memory, but sometimes it can be like your olfactory nodes. You might smell something that triggers you, but you don't really make the connection, but yet it sends the body into fight or flight. So it's really that fear that I have noticed that over time is people have panic about their panic. So it's like a layer. It's like people who are anxious have anxiety about their anxiety. It's like having anxiety about your anxiety. But when panic attacks already make people feel physically out of control, like there's something like a sense of doom, whether or not are they going to have a heart attack, very much it's treated similarly at the ER. People are given IV lorazepam, which is Ativan. I know they do that also for if someone, arrives with chest pain. There's a concoction for that as well, but it always includes lorazepam. So, and that is a benzodiazepine. I'm not really going to get into like who wants or asks for benzos. I mean, I'm not really interested in that at this point. So I'm not really going to talk about that. I find that that's really the essence. It's really having a total lack of control and feeling like you have a total lack of control over not only your headspace, but your body. And it's just kind of like this fight or flight mode. And it feels very real, and it feels like doom. And it makes people super anxious and vulnerable. And it does lead to, if it goes untreated, it leads to debilitating behaviors and lifestyle changes. Like Cora had said, sometimes people turn into stop driving, you know. Are you working with somebody who literally can't leave the house, or they have panic associated with crowds or socialized anxiety or whatever may be. They may have a complex trauma history, and something like unknowingly triggers a person into having a flashback or something in that case. So basically you have to kind of break it down into, well, benzodiazepines work. They do work, but they literally work like dry alcohol. If I'm redundant and I'm saying something over and over again, I don't mean to. I'm just trying to teach and educate people from what I know. And I'm no expert, and I'm not a genius. I don't purport to that. So I'm just sharing what I do know, and what I found on my own psychopharmacological journey, so to speak. So with panic disorder, you know, you really want to get somebody on a good dose of either an SSRI to increase serotonin to target anxiety, or an SNRI. So I'm just going to give you a couple examples. Like for me, if someone came to me with panic and I had them had neuropsych testing to rule out bipolar, I would be probably initiating like a medication like sertraline, which is Zoloft, or escitalopram, which is Lexapro. I like those two medications for panic, but panic disorder really in and of itself, to treat it in totality, not just as needed or as it happens sort of situation, which I'll also talk about. But it really is essential that you get one of these medications on board. And literally, we don't know which is going to work better. So it's kind of a crapshoot. So either someone needs more norepinephrine availability in their brain with something like an SNRI, like Effexor, which is venlafaxine. That's a superior medicine for anxiety and depression. Zoloft, sertraline, Lexapro, escitalopram. So I'm just naming three, but there are so many more. I'd be here all night. But those are the ones that I personally go for. Prozac is another one, all of which are FDA approved for treating panic and anxiety disorders. I could be incorrect about that, but that's sort of what I think I know. We use the SSRIs or the SNRIs. The lower doses, you know, the pharmacological companies don't do them justice by calling them antidepressants. I personally believe they should be calling them antidepressants, anti-anxiety medications, because I think that a lot of what I do and wind up doing is doing a lot of teaching with my clients who don't understand the mechanisms of medications and how they work related to dosage. So if someone had panic attack or anxiety disorder with depression, I'd be looking at using maybe if it was mono pharmacy or polypharmacy. So if it was like a one and done, I'd be working with an SSRI or an SNRI to target depression. I would be titrating that all the way to the highest dose possible in order for the depression to remit. However, with anxiety disorders, you don't necessarily need to, unless it's something like OCD, and not to be confused with OCD personality. This is just literally an OCD kind of presentation. I would be using, you know, something like Luvox, fluvoxamine, or any of the SSRIs are really good for OCD, but generally they wind up having to be on the higher end like in order to treat depression, because OCD can be kind of relentless. All the same time, cognitive behavioral therapy is completely and utterly essential because it teaches the brain and the mind to see things differently, and it teaches people to have a different reaction to certain situations. But I'm not going to talk about that because that's not really my lane. That's Corey's lane. But when it comes to panic attacks, you really need to know if there's a bipolarity going on, because you don't want to put someone on an SSRI or an SNRI without a mood stabilizer present fundamentally and stabilized. So let's say I have someone with bipolar disorder. Let's say it's bipolar 2. They've had testing done. I'm treating bipolar first. With bipolarity, there's a tremendous amount of anxiety that comes along with bipolar. It's not just, and people, and not everybody has just one diagnosis. Nowadays, it's like there's several diagnoses. So we're looking at layering medications in a certain way. The SSRIs and the SNRIs tend to, and the SNRIs particularly, they can trigger a manic episode, or they can make bipolar depression even worse and make a person feel suicidal. And that is the danger of using SSRIs kind of blindly when someone has panic. Although if there is no obvious signs, and, you know, a provider does a good history, and, you know, providers are only as good historians as the patient is. So a lot of times people don't recognize a manic episode or a hypomanic episode. They think they were just having wild fun, or, you know, and a lot of people, like I've said before, and I sound redundant, but it's very rare that people do show up in treatment for mania or hypomania, because usually people are feeling really good. They're feeling really productive. It's when the mania is so bad that it's impairing their functioning or person's functioning and judgment, so that they either get in trouble with family members or at work, or it spills over into like, wow, what's going on with you? You're like off the rails kind of thing. So they usually subsequently wind up getting help because they don't really have a lot of insight. Because again, let's come back to the stigma. You know, we call this bipolarity is it's neurotransmission. It's a mood seizure, but yet it comes out behaviorally. Now, I'm not going to get into bipolar, but that's one of the, you know, the things that you want to think about. Like, if you can get a full neuropsych eval, do that. You know, sometimes we're chasing symptoms. So, you know, clonidine's another medication that we use for panic attacks. It's not technically a control. It's not a controlled substance. Is it misused on the street? I'm sure it is, but it's not considered a benzodiazepine, but it does stop a panic attack dead in its tracks. So it really, but it doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier, so to speak, like a benzodiazepine does. And benzodiazepines tend to cross the blood-brain barrier, but they are also stopping the panic attack in its tracks as well, physically, as well as crossing the blood-brain barrier and soothing the mind as well, GABA. So there's lots of different ways to go about treating a panic attack, but in essentially you really want to get somebody on board with a medication, daily medication, until they can get into therapy, until the panic disorder ceases. And again, I didn't mention all the medications because there are plenty of them out there. But panic is it's a very unique experience, but I'm never really surprised at how common it is. And also, if you have a generalized anxiety disorder or a post-traumatic stress disorder that's not diagnosed, it, you know, panic will just rear its ugly head eventually. Not with everyone, but it can. So, you know, it's very important that it be treated. And the benzodiazepines do work. But they really are just, they work in the moment, but by the time, it's so important to have skills coping skills, grounding skills. Again, coming back to the five senses, not everybody can do this, but I think a lot of the research, or I think people talking out there, and I see a lot of this stuff on Instagram, psychologists and whatnot talking about, you know, what they do for panic. It's really just about getting yourself into a safe space and hopefully with a safe person. But if not, you stay until the panic passes. Psychologically, I think people do become dependent on benzodiazepines for panic but if you really look at it scientifically, it's almost like a vice, or it does work. But scientifically, sometimes it doesn't match the time frame of that panic attack, but it's a psychological, it's almost like Dumbo with a feather. I always tell my clients who I treat and who I prescribe to benzodiazepines for panic, or if they have PTSD or generalized anxiety, and I'm trying to get them stabilized on an antidepressant of which could, you know, kind of temper the anxiety overall. I'm always thinking about Dumbo with the feather, and not everybody's seen Dumbo. I mean, it's a very depressing movie, in my opinion. I couldn't watch it without bawling my eyes out. But there's this feeling of knowing it's there. If you know something that work. So what I do with my clients who do take benzos is like the goal is always to get them off of them. But sometimes people, even though they don't take them regularly, just knowing that they're there helps them to, in that moment, make a choice as they get stronger in therapy or on medication to say, do I really want to use this now? And that's what I see. That's when I see people making a lot of progress. You get, you know, we inherit or we take on clients that are really struggling and having a hard time, and they're really, they're panicky. I mean, they're afraid. There's a lot of fear. But as you work with them, you realize that, you know, it's so treatable. That's the point. Whether it is a benzodiazepine or if someone has bipolar, you think they do, you can ask your provider to talk or talk about buspirone. Buspirone is a medication that is strictly an anxiolytic, and that means that it just treats anxiety. That's all it does. It's not particularly sedative, so that's why it's helpful. The issue with buspirone is that it's dosed throughout the day, sometimes twice, sometimes three times, and it really needs to build up in the system for about 2 weeks in order to see a difference. But if you think, and I do this with my clients, if I suspect there's bipolarity or if they've had neuropsych testing and there's bipolar present, and I haven't truly stabilized them on an anticonvulsant or a mood stabilizer or an atypical antipsychotic that we also use, like lurasidone, which is Latuda, Vraylar, or any of the other antidepressants that we use for the treatment of bipolar, Abilify, aripiprazole, they're all like stuff we reach for to sometimes use in combination with a mood stabilizer, depending on what the patient needs. So, in my experience, buspirone has been helpful for clients that do experience a significant amount of anxiety, because if there's a lot of anxiety present, that has to be treated. And sometimes simultaneously, you'll get these people who have, you know, a few diagnoses that need to be addressed, but you have to be very, very careful about how you go about it. So I am just here not to treat anybody here. I am just here to share whatever knowledge that I have. I want to teach the world about this, and I just want to bring it all back to let's take the stigmatism out of mental illness. And we need to stop calling it mental. I mean, when I was growing up, and I don't want to date myself, but I remember people calling people mental, like you're mental. Like when someone asked, so for me, my association with mental takes me back to years and years ago of growing up at school or in the neighborhood where people use that in a negative way. So I guess we got to work on that. I got to figure out some other way to describe this so that people realize that this is really about neurotransmission. And because it shows up as behavioral, that's where people get judged. And you have to remember that it's neurotransmission. And some things, yes, they are behavioral. Of course they are. Some people have behavioral issues, yada, yada. I'm just talking about when it comes down to a specific diagnosis. And that's all I'm going to say about that right now. But I love you guys. Thank you so much. You really inspire us. And we really so appreciate your love and support. I want to be better about responding to people on Instagram, people who message us. They say lovely things. I send my love to all of you who do that and take the time to write thoughtful things about what we're doing. And you really encourage us and give us the fuel to keep going. And we wouldn't be anywhere without you. So we are truly grateful to our clients because they're our best teachers. And we are very grateful for all of what the world is bringing us. So thank you and God bless you.
Thank you, honey. So hopefully we're able to cover a very relevant topic that is something that is incredibly common. You know, I don't need to go into like the development and course of how it manifests throughout the lifespan, but you know, as I said before, err on the side of caution because you know of the similarities with the physiological symptoms. With cardiac or gastrointestinal, even the research, we've said this ad nauseum on multiple episodes, cognitive behavioral therapy, psychotropic medications have the best outcomes for the vast majority of all of the psychiatric conditions. Julia mentioned that she doesn't like the word mental disorders. I'm more of the scientist practitioner model. I think mental disorders is appropriate, but I think maybe another term could be cognitive disorders, cognitive behavioral disorders, styles. We do have a long way to go in this field in demystifying it and destigmatizing it. And I've said this before, I feel this is our modest version of God's work. Whatever you are diagnosed with or whatever a family member is diagnosed with, it is something you have. It is not something you are. Do not define yourself by whatever condition it is. If you put the work in, you will get the results. I brought up to Julie the other day, I want to try to find some way to start a foundation where we will be able to fly people in from all over the world who can't afford neuropsych evals to come see me for testing or consultations who are unable to afford it. Long-term projects, maybe starting a YouTube channel, something else, question answer forum. So I got a lot of ideas that go through my head. That's just how my mind works. But sincere gratitude and appreciation. And it's fun doing a lot of clinical consultation with you guys. And just an amazing audience and a blessed opportunity. And I'm still hoping to meet Bruce when we see him in Chicago. Or going to see him in Foxborough 2 times coming up and try and see him in Connecticut in the next September. So keep my fingers crossed and the angels are with us. But to all of you guys, be well. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Feel free to reach out to me through Psychology Today. You can get a hold of me through psychologyunplugged@outlook.com. You can follow us on Instagram at psychology_unplugged_, and you can contact me directly, 617-750-9411, East Coast Standard Time in the United States. Until next time, be well, and we'll talk. Bye, guys.